streets are screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, as promised last week, we're going to continue our discussion of the global financial economy here and what appears to be accelerating bubbles, financial asset market bubbles, which are usually an indicator of problems around the corner, not too distant future. All right, so let's define our terms a little bit before we begin. Financial. What do we mean by financial? Well, we mean financial markets, specifically stock or equity markets, as they're called, bond markets, which may be government bonds or corporate bonds, and different grades or degrees of corporate bonds, real estate prices, which could be residential or commercial property, foreign exchange or forex currencies, in other words, the dollar, the pound, the yen, the euro, the yuan, and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and all the others that are proliferating now. And then we have derivatives of all kinds, and it's hard to really see that because they're still pretty opaque, those markets, except for interest rate swaps. It's still no reform there to speak of, and who knows what's going on there. That, of course, tends to play a big role once the financial instability hits one of the former markets, and the derivatives play a role of exacerbating and increasing the contagion connection between all these markets and driving them lower. Okay, so those are the financial markets. What do we mean by instability? Well, we mean price bubbles, first of all. Financial bubbles, financial market bubbles. And price instability can be either those prices in those markets going too high or going too fast or too fast too high compared to what were normal historical averages. But instability is not just indicated by the price bubble. It's indicated more fundamentally what's driving the price bubble, and that is debt. Excess debt, excess leverage, particularly debt borrowing, credit and borrowing to finance purchases in financial asset markets we just mentioned. So debt, credit fuels the financial bubbles that we see reflected in the price increases. So you can look at instability as either the surface indicator of the inflation, the price itself, or you can look at it in terms of the underlying debt level, leverage level. Oh, but there's another factor here, and that is, even though debt may be excessive, creditors, those who loan the money that becomes the debt, may make it easier for the borrower, the debtor, to continue borrowing more in order to pay the principal and interest on the debt that's already been borrowed. These are called covenants in finance, terms and conditions in which the debt is borrowed. You know, the banks and whoever lends it could make it very easy on whoever borrowed, or it can make it tough on repaying the principal and interest. You know, they can ignore the payment of the principal and or the interest or both in order to prevent a default on the debt. Or they can be very strict on that and sometimes precipitate the default. Okay, so to summarize, it's prices, it's bubbles, but it's debt, leverage, and the terms and conditions of that debt that define what's meant by instability. and we're talking primarily here about financial market instability. And let's keep it clear that we're not just talking about banks. We're talking about this whole spectrum of financial institutions called shadow banks sometime. You know, private equity firms, hedge funds, and direct lending firms and so forth that have just exploded in recent decades and are actually bigger players than banks like J.P. Morgan and so forth. J.P. Morgan and those banks often feed the shadow banks, who then do a lot of the lending that drives up these and purchases that drive up these financial markets, or loan to wealthy individuals who do the same. And the wealthy individuals are really the owners of these hedge funds. You know, the capitalists and their institutions, the finance capitalist institutions, blend. All right, so it's debt and it's terms and conditions that drive these financial asset markets. Also, excess liquidity in other forms drive the markets. You don't have to borrow in order to invest in these financial markets. If you're a big investor, you may have tons of cash and liquidity of your own as a result of the last 8 years a really historic, unprecedented period in which the wealthy, 1%, 5%, those who invest, have accrued for themselves almost all the income gains since 2009. Yes, studies have shown 95% of all the net income increase has gone to the wealthiest 1%. 95%. I mean, doesn't that boggle your mind? They got it all. They got the whole recovery. And yet they tell us we have a recovery for the rest. Not according to the data. Not according to income. And by the way, income is also an important defining element of instability. You see, it's not just the debt and leverage and terms and conditions that drive up financial asset prices and these bubbles, which we're going to talk about shortly. We're laying the groundwork here, you see. We're talking about how to understand this. We don't want to just describe it. If you just want a description, just go read a Wall Street Journal, right? We want to understand what's behind it. Income is important. What do I mean by income? Well, you know, income for average folks like us is just your wage, you know, what you make on the job selling your labor. But for the wealthy, the income takes form of capital incomes, you know, dividends and interest and rent and all those other forms of incomes, tax rebates from the government, share prices, stock prices, etc. Those are capital incomes. That's where the 95% has gone. And when you got that much money hanging around, you got to put it somewhere. If you're rich, you don't let your money lay idle. You send it into financial asset markets or globally, where the returns on both financial asset markets and on commodity production and other highly profitable goods production, far more profitable than in the U.S., may be occurring. So, debt and income. Income is the ability to continue to pay the principal and interest on that debt. You know, a lot of books have been written here recently in years about, excess debt. But they don't explain, you know, how the excess debt is responsible for the financial asset bubbles. Nor do they explain the fact that you can keep accumulating your debt to record levels so long as your income, however defined, source, grows as well. you know, households can take on more debt as long as their income grows, as long as their wages grow, as long as their other sources of income grow, you can keep paying the principal and interest. So it's not just the debt level that's important, but it's the ability to finance that debt, in other words, to pay the principal and interest, that's the key. And the problems occur when the income is not available to finance, to pay the principal and interest. During good times, or times that appear good, you see, the debt keeps accumulating. I'm talking about here primarily corporate debt, because that's, in business, that's the big part of the debt, you see. Household debt, you know, is significant, but it's not the biggie. And even government debt is significant at $20 trillion, but it's not the biggie. The biggie is financial business and non-financial business debt. And that was at the source of the crash in 2008-09, and it'll be at the source once again. So it's the relationship between the ability to pay the debt, which includes the income you can generate from your business, or the assets of your business you might be able to sell in order to generate income to pay your principal and interest on your accumulated debt, or it might be the ability to borrow even more to pay the principal and interest on the old debt, you see. Income comes in many forms. It's not just earned income. It could be borrowed income. It could be income from selling assets, etc. Well, all these forms of income are critical for paying the principal and interest on the accumulated debt. But in good times, this debt just accumulates. I'm talking about business here. As businesses expand, particularly into financial areas as they have, you know, multinational corporations are really banks, the big ones. You know, one-third at least of their total profits come from financial investments, portfolio investments. Right, one-third is profits. It's not from selling things or services. It's from speculating in all these financial markets, and they've been doing that increasingly. They are shadow banks themselves, you see, the large corporations. Okay, so we're laying the groundwork here. We're talking about financial instability as reflected in financial asset bubbles, stock, you know, stock markets, bond markets, currency markets, real estate markets. But underlying that is this relationship between debt that's been accumulated and the income available to pay for the debt, and thirdly, the terms and conditions that banks may allow a borrower, a debtor, when they run up short on being able to pay the principal and interest. All right, keep these three relationships in mind here, debt, income, and terms and conditions. This is what I explored in my 2016 book, called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Fragility is an indicator of imminent instability, and it can be quantitatively measured. You take the level and rate of change of debt. You take the financial asset price bubbles, their levels, and you take the income available, as well as the terms and conditions, and that will give you a fragility estimation. And at some point, as fragility grows to excesses, it will erupt in a financial instability event. So fragility is an imminent indicator of imminent instability, you see. And if you listen to some of the reports coming out, which we're going to address here, you know, by the IMF and Bank of International Settlements in Geneva here, and this study, that just came out by Deutsche Bank researchers called The Next Financial Crisis last week. All of these reports came out last week, you know. In other words, more and more important areas of capitalist research are raising the red flag. Better listen. You know, they were doing that in 2007, eight, a few of them, but no one listened then. Why don't they listen? Because those who are engaging in the financial and other forms of speculation are making too much money. And they don't want to kill the golden goose, you see. They think they're smart enough to get out before the thing collapses. You know, 95% of them are always wrong. But they think so. You know, that's that herd mentality that investors have. They all think they're smarter than everybody else, but they find out that they're just like everybody else, thinking they're smarter than everybody else, but they're not. All right. And we're going to talk about what markets, what financial markets are most fragile right now, most unstable. You know, what is the Deutsche Bank researchers talking about? What's the IMF pointing to, or the Bank of International Settlements warning about now? And they're all come out here in recent months, indeed weeks, and individuals, key financial, global financial individuals are the same. Bill Gross, the bond fund king, and Walter Schäuble, the finance minister for the Eurozone, in fact. All warning, watch out. And we continue to stumble into the next one, which is coming. So it's not just debt levels. You writers who just talk about debt without explaining how the debt leads to the crises, you just have this correlation effect, you see. Well, how does it, what's the mechanism? How does it work? And obviously it's not the only variable of import here, debt. It's key. It's important, but it's not the only variable of import. As I said, it's the terms and conditions. It's the income liquidity able to pay the debt, and it's the debt level and rate of rise itself. And you can look at this three-way relationship not only within the financial sector or the business sector, but you can look at it as well within the household sector. Debt, increase ability to finance and pay the debt, conditions and so forth, right? And you can look at it within the government sector. You know, what's the income available for businesses to pay the principal and interest? Well, if they're a non-financial business, it's the income from the revenue that they sell. And if you're a bank, financial institution, you know, it's the spread that you charge and your other financial products and so forth. That's where you generate your income. Well, if you're a household, you generate your income mostly from your wages and salaries, unless you're the 1%, right? That's your income. The debt, of course, in the U.S., the biggies now are not the mortgage debt so much. It's credit card debt over $1 trillion, auto debt over $1 trillion, and student debt approaching $1.5 trillion. Those are the biggies. And now there's going to be more medical debt as this whole fiasco of the Affordable Act repeal begins to increase in instability as well. Okay, in the government, you know, what's the government income? The government income is really twofold. One, it's taxes, and it's the ability of the government to sell treasury bonds around the world to gather income from the sale of those bonds. And, of course, we know the federal debt's $20 trillion. Well, it's actually more than that because we have all the state debt out there, Illinois, Connecticut, Puerto Rico, and other states in deep trouble. So you look at this relationship between debt and income, ability to pay, and terms and conditions within those three sectors, household sector, business sector, government sector. And the income and the debt levels affect each other. There's a feedback. And then there's a feedback between the three general sectors as well. Anyway, that's what I cover in my book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy. You can read some reviews on my website or on Amazon, or go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. There are reviews there. My most recent book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, was an extension of that 2016 study, which describes, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, describes how the Federal Reserve, the central bank, and other central banks are at the core of generating, enabling all this excess debt. You see, you can trace back the cause to the central banks since the 1970s and accelerating. Anyway, that whole book is a description of how the Federal Reserve since the 70s, as well as the European Central Bank, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, People's Bank of China, are the fundamental causes, because they're the ones who generate all this liquidity into the economy, far more than is necessary to expand real investment that ends up enriching the 1% incredibly, which they then divert to financial asset markets, causing bubbles, makes them even more rich. And as these financial markets become so lucrative, it sucks money out of otherwise investing in real financial assets. In other words, real equipment, real investment creates jobs and income and so forth, right? Sucks it out. And that's why you get collapsing productivity in the real sector and goods and services prices that barely rise, while you got bubble prices rising in the financial asset markets. Okay. Enough on the book plugs here, but if you're interested, those two are related. Okay, continuing here. Not just debt, but ability to pay the debt, i.e. income and liquidity. And the two are what drives financial asset prices. Well, what markets are really running out of control in terms of financial bubbles? Well, obviously the most extreme today is cryptocurrencies, right? Bitcoin. Years ago I called Bitcoin digital tulips, because that's what they are. Right? Digital tulips, a reference to 1640s in Holland, you know, when all the speculation in tulip bulbs was occurring. Not because everyone thought tulip bulbs were worth anything, because they thought they could sell it the next day or right after they bought it for even more than they bought it. Pure speculative play, you see, and that's what Bitcoin is. It's a pure speculative play. It's based on a technology called blockchain, and that's what's driving the demand for it. But bitcoins are an example of money creation outside the influence of the Federal Reserve, the central bank. As I pointed out in my book, Central Bank is the End of the Rope, the central banks are losing control of the global money supply in a number of ways. Therefore, their policies are not that effective anymore. Interest rate policies tend to fuel the financial bubbles rather than the real economy, even when they drive those interest rates into negative territory, as they did in Europe and Japan. We haven't seen the last of negative interest rates. They're going to come back with a vengeance. Okay, well, what about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies? Well, 6 months ago, Bitcoin was selling for $1,000 a coin. Now, 6 months later, it's $5,000 a coin. Pure speculation. Well, when prices run up that fast, that high, for any financial asset, security, you know it's going to bust. It can't be sustained. And what we got is all these other competing cryptocurrencies emerging, Ethereum and so forth, right? And speculators see a way of raising IPOs, public offerings, and sucking stock all this excess liquidity from investors, high-risk investors chasing yield, into these new offerings of new competing financial cryptocurrencies. How many? There's over 1,000 now. 1,000 cryptocurrencies, either listed or floated or in the process. 1,200, I think, actually. I mean, talk about a bubble. This puts tulips to shame. Okay. But, you know, will this bring down the whole system? No. It's still too narrow. And it doesn't have the connectivity yet to all the other financial markets. You see, the big banks and shadow banks haven't really joined the frenzy. So if Bitcoin collapses, it's not going to drag everything else down, unlike other forms of derivatives, you see. It wasn't too long ago where we saw stock markets bubbles. You know, what about China in 2015? The stock market ran up within a year, 100%. 2,500 indexed to over 5,000 in less than 1 year. And it went down just as fast. And it almost brought down the Chinese economy. You know, if it wasn't for the fact the Chinese government had, you know, extreme powers to intervene in these markets and to stabilize them temporarily and to prevent currency outflow as the stock market collapsed and wealthy Chinese speculators and investors tried to get their money out of the country, quickly the Chinese government put a plug on that. But, you know, what they've really done in China is just to move the bubble around, which they've been doing for 3 or 4 years now, since they were also their central bank pumping massive liquidity since 2012 into that economy. And the money went out of stock markets into other bubbles in China, like the asset management products, right? Or into local property prices again in the big cities. It's very hard to put out the fire of a financial bubble. It tends to sneak out and go into another market, and the money, the liquidity, and create bubbles there. When you get too much excess liquidity all over, which is the case in China and in the U.S. and globally. Remember in 1987, it's the 30-year anniversary this month of the stock market crash in the U.S., where the stock market crashed 500 points in 1 day, almost a fourth of its value collapsed in 1 day. And that was precipitated by junk bond and property bubbles spilling over into the stock market. Okay. What about stocks today? What's the stock market? Well, we're near a bubble in the U.S. stock market. You know, the Dow, broad-based Dow Jones, has risen from about 15, 16,000 in early 2016 to over 22,000 today. Well, you know, it's not a result of real growth, productivity, and output of companies. It's not reflecting the real conditions. It's reflecting excess liquidity flowing into the stock market. It's about up about 40%. Almost, you know, in a little over a year, 18 months, a little over 18 months. And that's getting close to a bubble. Right? Since Trump, well, the bubble's accelerated, you see. Since Trump, we're approaching 20% now. Increase. But nothing. No real basis for it. Right? It's just anticipation, you see. Investors' anticipation. Oh, the companies are going to get a big tax cut, and that will raise profitability in the companies, and that will raise the prices of the stock in those companies. Therefore, let's invest now and reap that windfall, government tax-created profit. And to a lesser extent, anticipation of government spending fueling infrastructure, which isn't going to happen either. So those expectations can disappear, you see. It's all anticipation of the future that's driving the stock market, the Dow. And the same with the Standard & Poor's 500 large corporations. They've increased over the same period about 40% from 1,800 to 2,500. And since 2009, you know, 350%, you know, the S&P index was 750 in 2008-9, and it's 2,500 today. Okay, well. And, of course, you know, there's big profits from speculation, price acceleration there, big capital gains. It's not just the U.S. stock market today, markets that are in near-bubble territory. What about Japan? The Japan Nikkei 225 has hit daily records, just as the U.S. stock markets every day are hitting records. It's the highest since 1996 in Japan, the stock market. The German DAX stock market, daily records. China, highest in 2 years since the crash. All right, stock markets everywhere, equity markets everywhere are approaching bubble territory. And that's because of all the liquidity, the income that's flowing into these markets to buying these securities, financial securities, that isn't flowing into real investment. And that's why we're not getting real price increases in goods and services, and productivity is declining. Because the money capital is being diverted to the even more highly profitable financial asset markets. That's what's happening. Massive cash on hand. Massive cash on the sidelines and flowing mostly into these markets. Well, where did this massive cash, this income, come from? Well, U.S. profits, corporate profits, tripled since 2009. Tripled. And the corporations turned around and they bought back their stock, which drove up the demand and the price for that stock and made their shareholders very rich. And or they paid dividends at record levels to those same shareholders. How much? Well, I said it several times, and it's worth repeating on this show. $6 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts that U.S. corporations alone have occurred since 2009-10. $6 trillion. And now they want to cut taxes, Trump does, even more so on the corporations so they can give even more back. They want to cut corporate taxes, and they want to cut personal income taxes for the wealthy. Once they get that excess dividends and stock buyback income flowing to them, so they're going to cut taxes on the corporate side to allow even more flowed back, and once those catch the flow, they're going to cut their taxes as well. You know, we're going to get rid of the AMT, alternate minimum tax. 90-some percent of the benefit from the alternate minimum tax being repealed will accrue, 95%, I think, will accrue to households with annual income over $200,000. Yeah, which, who do you think that's going to benefit, right? Oh, but it's a middle-class tax cut, according to the big liar there, Donald, the Donald. And, of course, these tax cuts, business and other tax cuts, income tax cuts for the rich have been going on since George W. Bush. Right, we've talked about that last week, $15 trillion in tax cuts, most of it going to those folks. Well, what are they going to do with all that money, that income? They're not going to sit on it. They're not going to put it in a checking account, right? It flows into stock markets and bond markets and other property markets. That's where it's all flowing. And that's why you get the 95% going all to them, you see. But it's not just these profits and these investments from financial bubbles, capital gains, that are fueling these financial markets and bubbles in turn. It's also the very, very low interest rates created by the central banks that allow corporations to add to their profits by issuing corporate bonds, which is debt and commercial paper and other things. They issue the bonds because it's so cheap to issue bonds because the rates are so low because the Federal Reserve is pumping trillions and trillions of dollars into the economy, driving rates low. So these corporations issue this debt in the form of corporate bonds, and they take that money that they issued and they redistribute it along with their profits. You know, that's part of what driving the dividend payouts and the stock buybacks. And they got so much of it, some of them, like the tech companies, you know, that they don't want to pay taxes, so they send it offshore, you see, like Apple. You know, $260 billion in cash, 95% kept offshore, so they don't have to pay taxes to Uncle Sam. And it's not just Apple. It's tech companies, pharma companies, banks, energy companies. They're all the big players in that regard, you see. Yeah. So even solid, highly profitable companies issue corporate bonds and then redistribute the money. And all that liquidity, you know, gets pumped into these financial markets. But what about companies that are not in such good shape? Do they issue bonds? Yeah, they do too. They issue what's called high yield or junk bonds. And what they do is they're in such bad shape they can't make their payments on the previous bonds they issued. So they borrow more in order to make payments on the old bonds, principal and interest, and they borrow bonds on top of those bonds, you know, just like Greece. But it's corporate examples of the borrowing, adding more debt in order to pay the principal interest on the old debt. So junk bonds, borrowing. And then we have the phenomenon of emerging markets where companies and governments, emerging markets, are issuing bonds, not in their own currency, but in dollars because there's so much demand by U.S. investors and global investors who are sitting on so much money, they got to make it move somewhere, right? So it's fueling all of this emerging market debt, corporate and government emerging market debt, and yeah, dollarized market. And then we have margin debt in the stock markets itself. In other words, you're an investor, you can borrow money on paper to buy more stock based on the value of your stock. And if the prices of your stock are rising, you can borrow more and more. That's called margin, you see. Margin debt, margin buy. Played a big role in the bubble in the Chinese stock market in 2015, but it's playing a role here now as well. Okay. And then we have a phenomenon of non-bank credit. In other words, credit being issued without money. This is part of the financial tech revolution, you see. And we have direct lending and peer-to-peer lending and online lending. This is all fueling the debt as well, the ability of these new areas fueling the debt. There's mountains of dollars on the sidelines and being flowing in and out of these financial markets, causing these bubbles, you know. Mountains of it. Never before in history has there been so much money, a lot of it sitting on the sidelines. And as a crisis becomes more imminent, more and more of it will go to the sidelines, you see. But the force pushing in the other direction, these professional investors, you know, shadow banks, private equity, hedge funds, so forth, they got to move the money. They can't let it sit there forever, you see. They got to move it. And that's why when the stock market appears to correct 5%, you know, the institutionals pump their money back in and drive it back up, you see. The stock market should have corrected long ago. But the longer it doesn't correct, the more it gets into bubble territory. And when the correction comes, the bigger it will be. I predict when the stock market does correct, the U.S. stock markets, you know, you're going to look at a 4,000 to 5,000 point correction. From 22,000, you're going to go back down to 16, 17 at least. Because ever since the time 2 years ago, it was at 15, 16. It's just, it's not based on anything real anymore. It's just speculation, anticipation of Trump and or the Federal Reserve. Well, what precipitates the contraction? Well, it could be a number of things. We're going to look at the Deutsche Bank study. They indicated some of the possible precipitating forces. You see, we've been talking about fundamental forces, that is, central banks' excess liquidity creation and the debt run-up. Right, those are fundamental. Debt is fundamental, but not the only thing. And what's fundamental is when you have a reversal of the income growth necessary to finance the debt, then you get the bubble collapse and deflation, which leads to then defaults. And defaults accelerate the financial asset price collapses, and then it spills over into the real economy as the banks freeze up. And that exacerbates the financial asset price collapses even further, and then you're in a downward cycle. An unvirtuous downward cycle. And then the Fed's got to step in and try to bail it out. Oh, well, you know, that's what it did to the tune, central banks to the tune of $25 trillion after 2009. Since 2009, they've pumped it $25 trillion. Most of it going into these financial markets to keep these asset prices, stock prices, bond prices, whatever, from collapsing. That's where most of it went. You see, that's what the Fed was all about. You know, all this phony talk about 2% inflation target or unemployment at 4.4%, you know. That's phony. That's the cover. It's really about subsidizing the banking financial system, keeping it afloat. And then it becomes addicted to the free money, and the Fed and the central bank's got to keep pumping it and pumping it. And that creates the next financial bubbles and crisis, you see. They're on this wheel they can't get off until we have a crisis that's big enough that really changes the political institutions. Because very clearly, the political institutions are in the hands of the bankers. Goldman Sachs is running the show in the U.S. None of them are going to jail up to 2008-09. Right? We got a financial real estate commercial property speculator in the presidency, and he's got his Goldman Sachs buddies and all the other key positions, investment bank buddies. So they're running the show. And that's true. Same thing in Europe. Same thing in Japan. It's the same everywhere. You would think that they precipitated all these problems, they'd be pushed aside. But no, they've deepened their control and influence. So it's going to get worse. And they aren't in a very good position the next time it comes around. Okay, so I said at the beginning of this show, we were going to reference some of the warning sources, right? Some of the voices in the wilderness that have some responsibility, they feel, to say something about the problem. You see, it's the calm before the storm. The calmer the markets And the more risk-taking investors, because they think things are stable, the more that that appears underneath, the more unstable it's becoming until it erupts, you see. No one thought we'd have the eruption in 2007-8, right? Everything, look at the economy, was booming and so forth, right? Well, we saw what happened. Well, the same thing is happening now. It's the calm before the storm. Okay, so what are some of these voices in the wilderness? Even sectors of capitalism warned against it. There were those who warned against it in 2007, and we're seeing the warnings now coming out. The Bank of International Settlements that has for several years been warning about the run-up in global debt. In the September report, warned once again, excess debt accumulation. There's so much cheap credit, right, that it's running the risk of, quote, derailing the global economy, especially if the central banks try to raise interest rates. You see, that's one of the things that can precipitate the financial bubbles collapsing and the contraction on the financial side that then spills over and drags down the real economy. That can precipitate it. There are fundamental causes like excess debt, excess liquidity, lack of growth of incomes, especially in the sector, household sector, and in the government sector. But the precipitating event can set the whole thing off. The fundamentals get worse and worse, and the economy becomes more fragile. In other words, susceptible to a precipitating event having a big effect. But the precipitating events are different. Deutsche Bank study talks about that. Well, let's move on. The IMF, its Global Financial Stability Report, indicated the group of 20 largest economies have accumulated a debt pile for non-financial corporations alone of $135 trillion, 2.5 times their GDP. $135 trillion worth of debt in non-financial economies, corporations only. We're not even talking about the banks. And it talks about the complacency, right, tends to spawn financial excesses. Well, we're complacent, and the financial excesses are well underway. And the IMF says that if the stock prices decline just 15%, you know, and I'm predicting a lot more than that, and home prices 9%, it would cut the real growth of the global economy by half. That is, it would spill over and bring the real economy down to maybe 1.5% growth rate. Worst impacted by this would be Europe and emerging markets. One-third of the debt increase has occurred in China, one-third in the U.S., and emerging markets, and certain other key G20 economies are also weak, like the periphery of Europe, Canada, Australia. 30 big banks hold $47 trillion of these loans, or this debt now. 30 big banks, $47 trillion. $17 trillion of that is unsustainable. In other words, it's in a crisis, couldn't be paid. Insurance companies and pension funds are also especially weak. And the corporate junk bond, in other words, corporations that have to issue bonds in order to pay their old debt, and because they're not in good shape, they have to pay a higher interest rate. We call those junk bonds, right? It's also a weak sector. One-third of all corporations in the world are rated junk, or what's called BBB, three Bs, BBB rating. Bill Gross is called the Global Bond King. Has been warning for some time about the situation. And as he says, we have fake markets, unquote. and the Federal Reserve is following stupid theories like Phillips curves and Taylor rules. Still, you know, the economists perpetrating these nonsense ideas that are 1970s and before are no longer appropriate in a global financialized economy. They still believe that nonsense. And, you know, central banks are failing to understand the role of private credit creation. Wolfgang Schäuble, who was sometimes called the Treasurer of Europe, you know, he's a German finance minister who pretty much run the Eurozone finance policies, including squeezing, squeezing the life out of Greece and other financial markets. I talk about that in my book, Looting Greece, the New Financial Imperialism Emerges. Well, you know, emerges. And Wolfgang Schäuble was a key architect of all that. But he's retiring, you say, and he's going to take a sinecure job there at the German Bundestag and president of it. And took a parting shot when he left, talking about spiraling global debt and liquidity. Trillions. The central banks have been creating trillions in new bubbles, financial bubbles, right? And that non-performing bank loans are still excessively high, particularly in Europe and Japan, and can be a source of new precipitation of a crisis in the near future. Okay, that's Schäuble and gross. Well, what about the Deutsche Bank study itself? Well, it's entitled, interestingly, The Next Financial Crisis. It says we're in an area of financial crises that have been growing ever since the 1970s when central banks started creating excess fiat money currency, right? And that has, quote, enabled a debt buildup without parallel. Since 2009, debt has increased by $34 trillion, according to the Deutsche Bank economists. $34 trillion. Well, that's roughly equivalent to what I estimated in my book, Central Bankers in the Ropes, last month come out. $25 trillion central bank liquidity and $9 trillion government deficits. Pretty close. And the study concludes that the chances of a future crisis are, quote, overwhelming. Whoa, overwhelming. Bankers talking about overwhelming. Possible triggers, what I call precipitating forces or events, right? A recession. Why? Well, a recession means prices decline. It means financial asset prices will decline. And that could set in motion the whole process, because if your prices decline, your income available to finance your principal and interest declines. You see, price collapses are part of the whole process. Excess price acceleration, but when the prices start collapsing, the debt does not collapse. Just the income, the ability to pay the debt collapses, but the debt stays the same. In fact, the real debt rises, you see, if your prices fall. So price declines, when they occur, are deadly and set in motion an even faster, bigger problem. Now, banks could step in and offer more debt to those markets, more credit to keep to allow them to keep paying the principal and interest. You know, that could happen. Or the government could step in, as it did with the central bank, and provide liquidity, which would probably happen. But it's already provided tens of trillions of dollars. You know, how much more can it provide? Interest rates have not risen much. How much more can they lower them? They'll try to do that, and they'll press interest rates into negative territory. Unknowns. To offset the price declines, you see, that's what the Fed did last time, offset the price declines. Well, central banks selling off their debt could raise interest rates and cause a credit crunch, which I predicted, and therefore they won't. Negative rates are identified as a possible trigger. Deflation in real goods and prices and asset prices, a trigger. Excess asset price bubbles. You know, they're confusing triggers with fundamentals, of course. And what specific locations? Italian banks, China, Japanese central bank, buying up everything, including stocks, bonds, covered bonds, right? Those are all locations of possible crises, precipitation, you know, recession, deflation, sell-off, lack of financial market liquidity, which I'll talk about. Brexit, you know, looks like that's getting worse over there. Populist trends. Well, now we got Catalonia wanting to secede, as well as Scotland and others. And then they don't mention this, but I would add this, you know, Trump going off the reservation with regard to conflict with North Korea. Boy, that'll set the stock market in a tailspin. You watch. The Deutsche Study economists conclude that the situation we're in now can't be sustained indefinitely. There's no historical precedent for this, and they don't know what's next. There's many possibilities, but they do say it is coming. Okay, to summarize, what are the financial instability markets that are most prone or candidates for a financial instability event that will then spread through contagion, because these markets are all connected now? The U.S. stock markets, which is broad but not yet peaked. Cryptocurrencies, which are not broad but which are peaking. Exchange-traded funds and passive investing, which will accelerate the decline in stock and bond prices once it happens. This is a new phenomenon development, passive investing. Leveraged loans. Private equity, borrowing money, leverage loans to invest in mergers and acquisitions, $200 billion in the last year. Europe, particularly prone to this. Junk bond issuance, emerging markets, $220 billion in junk bonds issued, 60% increase over last year, and dollarized in dollars. China, entrusted loans, which are to its state-owned enterprises, which are really junk bonds. Zombie companies. In 2007, a study showed that 6% of all the companies in the U.S. were zombie. In other words, they couldn't pay principal and interest for 3 years and had to continue to borrow in order to pay the old debt. 6% of the companies. Today, it's 12% of the companies are zombie companies. If you look at BBB credit ratings globally, increased 100%, from 25% to 50%. In the UE, 20% of the companies were BBB, junk bond rated, in 2008. Today, 50%. In the U.S. in 2007, 35% were BBB junk related. Today, it's 50%. And then we got what's called the repo market. Repo market, $3.5 trillion, where borrow from each other using treasury bonds as collateral. Well, the liquidity is shrinking. And we have government agencies, clearinghouses, increasing the emergency fund from $50 billion to almost $100 billion. Desperate reforms underway by the Fed and others to try to head off a liquidity crisis in the repo market, which is very, very critical. And then we have the big banks, particularly in Italy and Japan. These are all candidates for the next financial instability event and crisis. So take a watch them, and we will, on this show. And that concludes our coverage of an update of financial instability globally in the markets and where we are and how close we are to another financial global instability event. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.